one of the more dramatic or poetic discourses, sermons that the Buddha gave. It's called the Fire Sermon. It's pretty well known by many people. I once was surprised to come across it in a volume of the best speeches ever given by in the history of humankind. It was the Buddha giving his Fire Sermon. And maybe you have to have a sense of some great orator like Martin Luther King expounding this to give maybe a sense of its power potentially in this, but I'll read it for you. The Buddha addressed the monks and nuns. Everything is burning. And how is everything burning? The eye is burning. Visible things are burning. The mental impressions based on the eye are burning. The contact of the eye with visible things is burning. The sensation produced by the contact of the eye with visible things, be it pleasant, be it painful, be it neither pleasant nor painful, that also is burning. With what is it burning? It is burning with a fire of greed, with a fire of anger, with a fire of ignorance. It is burning with the anxieties of birth, decay, death, grief, lamentation, suffering, dejection, and despair. The ear is burning. The sounds are burning. The nose is burning. Odors are burning. The tongue is burning. Tastes are burning. The body is burning. Objects of contact are burning. The mind is burning. Thoughts are burning. All are burning with a fire of greed, of anger, and of ignorance. Considering this, a practitioner walking the noble path becomes disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with visible things, disenchanted with the mental impressions based on the eye, disenchanted with the contact of the eye with visible things, disenchanted also with the sensation produced by the contact of the eye with visible things, be it pleasant, be it painful, be it neither pleasant nor painful. He or she becomes disenchanted of the ear and so forth, down to thoughts. Becoming disenchanted of all that, one divests oneself of grasping. By absence of grasping, one is made free. And when one is free, one becomes aware that one is free. When this exposition was propounded, the minds of those thousand monastics became free from attachment to the world and were released from all entanglement. So the fire of greed, the fire of hate, and the fire of ignorance. And the image of fire is an ancient one in India. And the image of the fire is one of... Fire is always agitated. Maybe occasionally a flame is very smooth, but fires are always kind of an agitated state. And many people find themselves in agitated states, restless states, from greed, hate, and delusion, despair, dejection. And it's this burning which is the ultimate focus of Buddhist practice, is to cool the burning, to lessen the agitation, the restlessness, so we can just be at peace, we can be cool. American monk Santikaro signs his emails, "Be cool, Santikaro." Mm-hmm. So go from restlessness to rest, to go from agitated mind to the unwavering mind, to the peaceful mind, peaceful heart. Now, restlessness and agitation are all too common in this world, as we know. And when it's really strong, we can certainly feel the burning that the Buddha talked about. The burning fever of desire, the fever of anger, the burning of anxiety, of regret and jealousy. There can be restlessness and agitation of the body, and there can be restless agitation of the mind. And part of what practice involves is confronting and meeting and recognizing the forces of agitation and restlessness within us. And what's been very instructive and helpful, I believe, is that in this schema that the Buddha laid out of the various fetters that a person gets released from as they get enlightened, and one of the last things that person gets free from, even after you're freed of ill will and strong sensual desire and craving, after that, there might still remain restlessness or agitation. It can be a very, very refined, very subtle movement that only with the full awakening and the model of the path is restlessness and agitation finally released, ultimately, completely. And this model, the idea is that the restlessness and agitation are actually part of, even someone who's partially enlightened, it's still part of their mind. Very quiet, very subtle mind of meditation can still be involved with agitation and restlessness. Sometimes it can be so subtle and so masked by the calm that we do have, we don't see how the mind is still wavering or agitated or restless in the midst of a great, great pool of stillness and calm. The opposite of maybe an agitated mind is a still mind, unmoving mind. But another opposite, perhaps, is a mind or heart of contentment. It could be content, deeply contented. An agitated mind is one which is not content in the present moment. It doesn't have the trust or the sense of well-being that allows one to be contented in the present. It's important to recognize the agitation of the mind because it's a kind of a uncomfortable state. And it tends to be, in various ways, to be self-perpetuating. It's kind of, because it's uncomfortable, we get agitated by it, which causes more agitation, which makes us more agitated. And sometimes it can be kind of self-fulfilling or self-fueling agitation, kind of an endless cycle. Self-propelling, self-reinforcing. Outside of retreat, perhaps, maybe not so much here, but it can take the form of the fingers always tapping and playing with the fingernails, or the hands always fidgeting, the feet, you know, never really still, but kind of restless under the table, under the chair. We're squirming. Physically, mentally, we're chasing after thoughts, concerns. Never really even settled on one, which is kind of this and that and everything we want. Never really settling on anything at all. And in all that movement of agitation, we might not notice how we're actually feeling. And this is one of the characteristics of the agitation and restlessness. It actually kind of turns our attention often away from itself, and we don't see it for what it is because we're so involved in the objects of our preoccupation and concerns. The busy mind chattering away in agitation, especially outside of retreats, we can take it for granted. This is the way things are. We become so busy, we don't see. We're running around being so busy, we don't see how fast the mind is. Maybe in the first day of the retreat, some of you were surprised by how agitated or how busy or fast your mind was. So the agitated mind can be self-generating. For example, desire breeds more desire. Desire also can easily direct us away from ourselves. And that very alienation of being directed away from ourselves, whether it's desire for things or desire for experiences or desire for something better than what's happening right now, it can be a kind of gross or very subtle alienation from ourselves, which creates a vacuum that is often uncomfortable, which many people then want to fill with more desire. Because the only thing we know what to do with vacuums or discomfort is to try to find something which will soothe it or fix it, take care of it. And in doing this, in being propelled outward by agitation, by desire, we often go against our own best self-interest, which is to find a very deep peace, contentment with life and with ourselves. So again, the restlessness and agitation in mind can be very subtle forces. They can still be operating even when there's a lot of calm present. And it can be useful to start recognizing and seeing it. In fact, it might be said that that restlessness or agitation is one of the universal companions of our suffering. Some would say that agitation is the root of our suffering. It's why we suffer. So certainly the mind is agitated when it's reaching outside of itself or inside of itself for something which is going to kind of be the fix, be the solution. Something else, when we want something outside, we want or we resist because it has some impact, we believe, on our deep fundamental integrity and well-being. This is, these are kind of nice. The Buddha said, if outsiders speak against me, against the teaching or against the Sangha, you should not be angry for that. You should not be angry, for that would prevent your own self conquest. Similarly, if they praise us, but you should find out what is false or true and acknowledge the fact. And even in praise, it is only of trifling matters that the unpracticed, the unenlightened person might speak of me. So even the kind of things that we receive praise for, fame for, the Buddha calls this trifling matters. Don't be influenced by criticism or praise. At one time, Shakyamuni Buddha was staying at the town of Kosambi. In this town, there was one who resented him and who bribed wicked men to circulate false stories about him. Under these circumstances, it was difficult for his disciples to get sufficient food for the begging, and there was much abuse. Ananda said to the Buddha, we had better not stay in a town like this. There are others and other and better towns to go to. We had better leave this town. The Buddha replied, suppose the next town is like this, what shall we do then? Then we should move to another. The Buddha said, no, Ananda, there will be no end in that way. We had better remain here and bear the abuse patiently until it ceases, and then move to another place. There are profit and loss, slander and honor, praise and blame, pain and pleasure in this world. The Buddha is not controlled by these external things. They will cease as quickly as they come. So the pursuit, so one of the sources of agitation for people, as many of us know, is what's called the eight worldly dharmas. Profit and loss, slander and honor, praise and blame, pain and pleasure. These are the kind of the winds they go through that kind of destabilize us, both by getting a profit and by having loss. Receiving honor and getting slander from both of them can agitate the mind, even though one of them might be very pleasant initially. They tend to keep us unstable. So some of the causes of restlessness, talk about it further. Think about all these causes as being interrelated, I think. Is useful. One of them is wanting pleasantness, wanting things to be pleasant and comfortable, and wanting to avoid the unpleasant or the uncomfortable. These are very powerful forces for humans. And there's both physical comfort and mental comfort, both physical discomfort and mental discomfort. And it isn't that we need to kind of always accept the discomfort, but it's often a source of our agitation. And there's no need to be agitated in the face of discomfort, of the unpleasant or the pleasant. But constantly wanting things to be pleasant than they are, or avoiding the unpleasant, is one of the primary sources of agitation. You might see it even in the subtlety of your meditation. Things are quite subtle. How you can still be a little bit agitated, a little bit restless, wanting things in your meditation to be a little bit more pleasant. Well, here comes something which isn't quite pleasant. May I kind of avoid that? I don't want that. Oh, not that. Things were so pleasant for the last two sittings. And now there's some discomfort is coming up. Oh, then you can feel not only the resistance to that, but then the judgments of what it means. Oh, I must have made some mistake. I must have taken the wrong corner in the last walking meditation. How could I, you know, make that decision? And so the mind gets agitated. Another source for agitation, which appears as a very commonly described source in the Buddhist suttas, is regret and the fear of blame. That if somehow we've done something in the past that we regret, then they will often get agitated because of that. Maybe the fear of getting blamed, the fear of being caught, the fear of the consequences of it. And that can also lead to agitation. But here in the West, the understanding in the suttas is that you've really done something inappropriate, and that's why you're agitated. Here in the West, that level of agitation doesn't seem to be based on having done anything at all. Somehow you have the idea that just, you know, I did something wrong with being born. You know, just, I'm breathing, and that, you know, and that's bad, or I'm walking, you know, and heaven forbid that I should be walking, you know, I don't deserve to be walking, you know, or I'm walking the wrong way, or we can have this tremendous sense of inadequacy and lack of self-worth, that somehow we have this assumption operating, or this belief, or this, that we have something to be ashamed of, or something to hide from others, or something that makes us somehow fundamentally flawed. And that kind of belief, very deep-rooted belief, can lead to a lot of agitation. It can make it very difficult for us to come to rest in ourselves. It feels that we don't deserve to rest. We don't deserve the joy of the still, quiet heart and mind. So it can be very useful to actually take an honest look at our anxiety or fears about ourselves and see if they're unfounded. Upon what authority are they founded? And many times you probably find it's in a vague sense. Or someone else's authority, perhaps, something a parent said when you were a child. Do they know? Do they have the authority to say actually who you are? Another source of restlessness is the movement of defending ourselves, of building ourselves up. And any movement to defend oneself or build oneself up, to create an identity, how we're going to represent ourselves to the world or to ourselves, is inherently unstable. So not only is that movement agitating, but it's unstable in itself to kind of have that construct. And so that instability we feel and sense, and it makes us worried and afraid and want to constantly kind of prop it up. It needs to be propped up. A lot of it has to do with concern about how others see us. Or, you know, how we've internalized the fear of how others might see us. We end up often hiding parts of ourselves, even from ourselves, let alone from others. Or manufacturing parts of ourselves, you know, creating certain ways, talking to people as if only saying but not what we think that they want to hear. In order to get, you know, so they see us in a good way and think well of us. So we're safe in their eyes or whatever. But the movement to defend and build ourselves up, to have an identity, me and mine, that I'm going to hold on to, causes agitation. There's a wonderful passage in the suttas where there's this monk named Anuruddha, who's fairly well-practiced, very deep, serious practitioner, who was still not fully enlightened. And he went to Venerable Shariputra, who was one of the more highly accomplished disciples of the Buddha. And he greeted, Anuruddha greeted Shariputra courteously. After an exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat down to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Venerable Shariputra, "By means of the divine eye, purified and surpassing the human, I see the thousandfold cosmos. My persistence is aroused and unsluggish. My mindfulness is established and unshaken. My body is calm and unaroused. My mind is concentrated into singleness." Sounds pretty good. You wish you had that, right? When's it going to happen to me? "And yet, my mind is not yet released through the lack of clinging. There's still clinging within me." And Sariputta answered, "My friend, when the thought occurs to you, by means of the divine eye, purified and surpassing the human, I see the thousandfold cosmos. That is related to your conceit. When the thought occurs to you, my persistence is aroused and unsluggish. My mindfulness is established and unshaken. My body is calm and unperturbed. My mind is concentrated into singleness. That is related to your restlessness. When the thought occurs to you, and yet my mind is not released from clinging, that is related to your anxiety. It would be good, it would be well if, abandoning these three qualities of conceit, restlessness, and anxiety, by not attending to these three qualities, you directed your mind to the deathless property, to the unborn, to that which is still, to incline the mind to peace." So he did. He abandoned those three things. All he had to do was point out. So even when mind gets very subtle, very peaceful, and very strong states of concentration and mindfulness, there can still be operating this little, still be operating restlessness, conceit and anxiety. And it's helpful to notice that, to notice how it still operates, and then incline the mind towards peace and stillness. Then the fourth thing I was talking about the reason why we are often restless or agitated, is we want certainty, we want security. And often we look outside of ourselves for the solution, for security, for certainty, to really know, now I really know what the truth is. I want an experience which is undeniably true, so I can always, I know that I'll never kind of, I have something to rely on, to hold on to. I can go through the world and kind of hold it, you know, hold that as my little touchstone. I know what the truth is, and then I'll go through the world just really safely, or just really well, or, you know, I'll be the coolest person in town because I'll have this badge saying, "I know what the truth is. I know once and for all." If that's your situation, this is an amazing letter that Ajahn Chah, who apparently never wrote letters, wrote this letter to Ajahn Sumedho when soon before he became incapacitated, had a stroke. And this is his final message to Ajahn Sumedho. He wrote to him from Thailand to England. "Whenever you have feelings of love or hate for anything whatsoever, these will be your aids and partners in building paramitas, the paramis, the perfections, building the qualities of strength that support our practice." And that was a wonderful positive approach. So we don't have this negative attitude towards clinging. Love here means clinging, attachment, and hate. And we see it's really the fuel which allows us to kind of practice. It's what practice is built on. When Ajahn Jomyen was at the Spirit Rock some years ago, he talked about suffering as being holy. Holy suffering. Because the first noble truth is the noble truth, the holy truth. And there's some nobility to suffering. If you know how to see it from the perspective of the Four Noble Truths, then there's holy suffering. There's noble, sacred suffering. If you see it that way, if you don't see it that way, then it's unholy suffering. But here, that our greed and hate are the aids and partners in building paramitas. And the next sentence, this is next to it I wanted to stress. The Buddha Dharma is not to be found in moving forwards, nor in moving backwards, nor in standing still. This, Sumedho, is your place of non-abiding. Not moving forward, not moving backwards, not standing still. The answers are not found outside of us, and the answers are not found inside of us, or in either place. It's found in the mind of non-abiding, the mind of stillness, the mind which is tranquil. So how do we cultivate rest? How do we cultivate? A number of you, and we talked about your intention for being here, talked about rest as being, are you coming here for rest? That was a very good motivation for many of us. And there's layers and layers of rest. Nirvana is the ultimate rest. How do we cultivate the unmoving mind, unagitated mind? One way is by appreciating stillness. Appreciating the unagitated mind when it's there, the unagitated body, the unagitated heart. And I don't know if you're conscious of it, but often when I think there's a lot of stillness in this room. Maybe there isn't always silence. There's a lot of stillness there in the sendo. I think it's very profound, very helpful to feel the stillness and let the sensations that you're paying attention to, the breath you're paying attention to, somehow occur within, be held within the stillness. It kind of highlights it, and sometimes it's very helpful for mindfulness. To appreciate the unmoving presence, a kind of meditation that some people do, kind of introductory kind of meditation, is that of the mountain meditation. Kind of imagine you're a mountain. Works really well if you're sitting cross-legged. It's this triangle of mountain, very stable and rooted, unmoving. Another way of cultivating stillness is to appreciate, is to meet your restlessness, your agitation with stillness. As I said, you know, to feel the stillness of the room, or feel the stillness within your body, and somehow let whatever agitation is there be held in that stillness. To meet, to they meet each other, and certainly seeing the restlessness is important. This is the main point I'm trying to make in this talk, that there are layers and layers of agitation. It gets more and more subtle. And it's useful to notice that. The hindrances get more and more subtle, the stiller we are. And it's useful to be able to recognize the hindrance. And the restlessness is one of the hindrances, restlessness and anxiety. Really see it so we don't get led astray by it. It doesn't take us off away from the present moment, away from what we're paying attention to, away and into our thoughts and ideas. What can be worse than that sometimes? Sylvia Borstein tells a story of once finding herself not really waking up from the attack of the hindrances until after she'd finished all these telephone calls in the middle of a long retreat, maybe a 3-month retreat at Bering, changing her flight itinerary so she could leave earlier from the retreat.
And as you get all this work on the funds, so I mean, it's not just simply that mind wanders off. And extreme force, extreme, anyway, it's extremely powerful. We move off. We get up and we move. How many times have you moved? Just physically squirmed when you're sitting. Not because you needed to, but because there was the unseen agitation working through us. So it's physical agitation, and the body is restless. It's very helpful to hold it in a wider container of stillness of the room, or wider stillness of the body. Let the body be a container, a generous, compassionate container for the restlessness of the body. And sometimes just holding it there, letting the body be a container for restlessness. Restlessness will always quiet itself, always settle itself with time if we just hold it compassionately, generously, with loving kindness, and just allow ourselves to feel it. The nature of restlessness to quiet down. The agitation of the mind will also quiet down if we hold it with compassion and care. We receive it with a mindfulness, receive into stillness of the mind. Have a little bit of sense of mindfulness, having a quality of stillness to it that we kind of meet the agitated mind with. Sometimes that can work. The awareness is held still, tranquil, at peace. Another way of maybe saying this is to meet a restlessness with a non-reactivity, non-reactive awareness. It allows it to be there. We're not trying to get rid of it. That's just another form of agitation. We're just trying to discover how to bring forth the non-reactive mind in the midst of all things. Some people talk about having a still center. I think it's more useful to have the notion of a sense of a still container for restlessness and agitation. Have a wider sense of containing it within stillness, so that all those things can move freely within that wider stillness, and they kind of quiet down with time. We can cultivate stillness by considering seriously who we are, what we really need for our well-being, and what our priorities are. Agitation can arise out of anxiety about our life and what we need and what we should be doing and what's important. It's very easy to develop yogi mind when the mind is concentrated and still. And the yogi mind is the mind which loses perspective, and the concentration kind of zeroes in on something and just sees this is really important. Someone serving himself salad, and all you see is one little cherry tomato on top of this bed of salad, and they're ahead of you. And it's the most important thing in the world is you need to have that tomato, and you just watch the way the prongs go, you know. that was my name on it, I'm sure. You know, that's yogi mind. You know, we just like, how could they not have known that cherry tomatoes are my favorite, or whatever. And we lose perspective sometimes. And the mind gets agitated. It's very important to know about the yogi mind so you can see it when it arises. It's okay to have it arise. It's, yogi mind. Things loom in much greater importance. And one of the ways the yogi mind works is, you know, we can spend months and months planning to come on retreat. It's really important for us to come on retreat. It's like really represents the deepest intention. And then we're here at retreat only for 12 days. That's a relatively short period of time for our life. And then finally we're here, we're in the middle of it, and it just seems like we lose kind of perspective. This is just a short period of our life. Most of our life is still going to happen, you know, and we have lots of opportunities to do things. And suddenly, you know, I can't do this because there's all these important things I have to do now, you know, all these, you know, important things I have to figure out and do and, you know, whatever. You know, and because kind of the yogi mind loses track of how precious it is to be here, our priorities. The only kind of focus on the present moment is this is the only place it can occur and happen. All these desires and wishes and needs for accomplishments. To kind of reevaluate a little bit our priorities. Maybe remind ourselves of where we are sometimes can be helpful. So we can rest more, just be here in a simple way. Stillness, or unagitated presence, can come from emptying ourselves of all the superfluous ideas, surface chatter of the mind, the surface engagements of the mind, thoughts. There's an interesting exercise you can do in this way, emptying ourselves of superfluous ideas. They relate to our sense of self, which is so fundamental to our agitation. So imagine, maybe close your eyes if you want, if you do this or not. Imagine that you can take away all the ideas you have about who you will be in the future, what you will become. And then take away all the ideas of who you've been in the past and what's happened to you in the past, what you've accomplished and not accomplished. And then take away any comparisons you have of yourself to others that is occurring in the present moment. Without any comparison of yourself towards anybody else in the universe. Take away future thoughts, past thoughts about yourself, and comparative thoughts about who you are in relationship to someone else. Take away the ideas of what other people think of you. When you've emptied yourself of all this, who are you? Take away the assumptions that I am separate from others, separate from the world. Take away the assumption that I am at one with the world, I'm not separate. Take away any notions of I am. Just awareness in the present moment. So much of the agitation we can feel on the notion of self has to do with ideas of future, past, comparative thinking, concerns what other people think about us. And it's possible to be present and alive without any concerns of those, and feel vital and alive and free. Caught up in concerns about what we can become and who we have been, things about the future and the past, great projects we can or want to do, you might ask yourself the question, if not now, then when? If not now that you can be present for yourself, not now you can be engaged in the present moment, there is no other time but now. For that. Can you put it off for a different now? A different now and a future now. There's no guarantee that's going to be any better, any easier, or even be here for you. Will you be there for it? If not now, then when? So we cultivate stillness by not looking elsewhere. Future, past. But rather we just look, we just are attentive. We bring a wonderful bubble of awareness, of presence. See what's happening now, what's happening now. The Buddha, in the Udana verse, writes, said, "One who clings is agitated. One who clings not has no agitation. There being no agitation, one is calm. There being calm, no craving exists. Where no craving exists, there is no coming or going. Where no coming or going exists, there is no arising or passing away. When neither arising nor passing away is, there is neither this world nor a world beyond, nor a state between. This, just this, is the end of suffering." So mostly, be attentive to agitation when it's there. Notice it. Notice it, how it might stimulate the drifting mind. And see if you can use the awareness of restlessness or agitation within you as a way of encouraging you to be more steady, to look more carefully, to be even closer and more steady on whatever you're paying attention to, the breath, the sensations of the breath, the sensations within your body. So there can be a stability, a steadiness, so it becomes less and less wavering, that focus, more relaxed, more at ease. One of the forms agitation can take is actually fixation, very brittle kind of fixated stability. Really a variety of agitation. Giving it a stability, a just really soft, accepting presence. It really focuses very intimately and carefully. Noticing when the hindrance of agitation gets there. It's in the way. Sometimes you can easily let go of it or not let it kind of affect the focus. Sometimes you need to kind of actually take a very, it's very strong, the agitation, really address it fully in the way that we know how to do through mindfulness. They kind of focus that we're talking about, focus of concentration and mindfulness, kind of clear seeing you're developing here. It's important, I think, to have a sense of a broad sense of allowing, openness that's around it. Very clear focus, but then a sense of allowing something to bubble up through your body, something else to happen. A sense of open possibility as you have that. Something unknown, even. Open possibility of something known, kind of around the edges of that, of whatever focus you can develop. The open possibility, the open stillness that's all around. So may this talk be of help, hopefully, for your inclining towards increasing stillness, increasing rest, ease in your practice. Thank you.